Hello and welcome to the program. My name is Luke Hunt and this is another broadcast for the Beyond the Mekong podcast series published by The Diplomat. And with me today is Bradley Merg, Associate Fellow with Pacific Forum. And today the discussion is Burma, Myanmar, and is it a failed state? Brad, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Luke. It's great to be back.
It is. It's good to see you again. The question about whether or not Myanmar is a failed state was put forward a couple of years ago by Tom Andrews out of the United Nations. Does Myanmar measure up as a failed state?
So the first thing we have to do is we can look at the metrics, but first thing we have to do is define what a failed state is.
Yep.
And a failed state in political science comes out of the work of Max Weber. Max Weber, the famous sociologist and the father, really, of modern state theory, and who basically said that, yeah, it's fundamentally based upon legitimacy and, but overwhelmingly, the question of monopoly of violence. Does a state have a monopoly on violence on its territory?
Mm-hmm.
And very obviously, for the sake of looking at Myanmar, no, the government of Myanmar doesn't have a monopoly on violence. We know that the regular statistics doesn't even control half the territory of the country at this stage. So from a very, very simple definition of is Myanmar able to have that monopoly on violence, yes, I would say Myanmar qualifies as a failed state. Now, there's quite a few other and more expansive definitions.
And violence sounds so harsh.
It does. It does. It doesn't. When you teach that to undergraduates, it's usually a bit of a shocking term, monopoly on violence. But with the case of Myanmar, it's also ranked. We have other metrics as well. So some folks don't like the term failed state. Some have critiqued it for various and sundry reasons. But other folks use what's called the Fragile States Index,
mm-hmm.
with Somalia traditionally being on the top. Somalia is actually where we came up with the term failed state back in the 90s. Myanmar ranks 11th there, significantly higher than anyone remotely within ASEAN, obviously. So some folks think, okay, well, we view it as a very, very fragile state. Not failed, but it has a high probability of failure. And so it comes to the question of, well, what would that look like if we're simply saying it's a failed state in terms of political science definition versus what other folks saying, well, we're warning it's going to become. And I interpret that very much as folks saying, well, that's the collapse of the junta. That's the collapse of the regime within country at the moment.
Right. So according to other definitions, it's the government of the day needs to be able to control its borders.
Yep, which Myanmar does not.
It needs to be able to police the entire country.
Which Myanmar cannot do.
And it also needs to provide basic essential services, water, sewage, health, education.
Which, and, as we... Nope, not there either.
So by any measurement, really, Myanmar is a failed state. But ultimately, I think you're saying it can't be called a failed state unless the junta collapses.
In practice, that's what folks are thinking of it as. Is okay, if the junta's there, well, it's still there. But by most definitions, it really qualifies at this stage as a failed state.
Okay. So where does that leave the rest of the world, given that the junta is promising to hold elections by January, and everything we've seen is that, at best, it might be able to hold a vote for about half the population. And that's in the cities.
In preparation for the elections, the government attempted to conduct a national census in order to develop the voter rolls and so on and so forth. We saw that, no, they were unable to do so. They were only able to do so in about 50% of the country's townships. So you're going to have incomplete voter rolls. No one thinks this is going to be a free and fair election based on the usual determinants. You don't have a free media. You have thousands and thousands of opposition figures sitting in jail. So in terms of the practicalities here, yeah, it's going to it will probably take place, but it's very much supported by China and quite a few other states. But it's not going to be legitimate in any sense of the word.
I mean, there is a term, horseshoe politics. There's different ways of trying to grapple with global politics at the moment. But in terms of staging this election, it's a little bit like, what's the point? I mean, China is not a democracy. The countries that have backed Myanmar mm-hmm. aren't exactly glowing representatives of a democratic society. So why are they doing this?
Well, for some folks have looked at China's relationship with Minhong Huang and have said, well, they don't like the guy. They don't think he's competent, and they don't see him as the ideal partner in any way whatsoever. So this is something that could possibly bring new people to the fore and just present new options For China, which sees the current status quo as basically not good, to put it mildly, and see things move ahead. For ASEAN states, who have had significant discussions about this since foreign ministers' meetings in December of last year, as well as in January of this year, where we saw significant division in ASEAN as to how to move ahead, not just not necessarily just on elections, but on the Myanmar crisis as a whole. Hmm. So where we have differing positions stated in December on the five-point consensus on whether it's actually workable or whether a new tax should be taken. The Philippines very much made that argument that something else should be done. And we still see with the elections coming, yes, there is support for many ASEAN members saying, well, we have to support this to ensure that there is legitimacy for this, and this will move ahead. This also then moves into folks now talking about sending election observers. Cambodia has offered to send election observers. Mm-hmm. The Philippines, I'm told, has offered to send election observers. But remember, ASEAN doesn't send election observers.
Right.
ASEAN hasn't done that since here in Cambodia back in the 1990s. So this is also a big shift for ASEAN if it's going to be active in this electoral process.
So that'll give them, I guess, some form of legitimacy, and one of the rest of the world countries, from Australia to Canada to the United States, Europe,
will not recognize. I can't see any situation where they would. It also, though, for ASEAN, risks an enormous backlash among the population of Myanmar that is opposed to the junta. Doesn't want to see a whitewashed election with the support of the other ASEAN states.
Right. That's what brings me back to that original point. And of course, China has got its oil and gas assets, the 770-kilometer pipeline across Rakhine State. Rakhine is rapidly falling to the Arakan Army, which is also closing in on Sitwe. And then there's the speculation about the joint security company between the military and China, which would require Beijing to put boots on ground. We don't have it confirmed, but my understanding is 50 troops have arrived in two batches of 25 and are now settling in along the oil and gas pipeline right across the country. I mean, this is seriously changing dynamics.
This is really big, and I'm surprised it hasn't gotten more attention. Last year we saw the joint agreement between China and Myanmar to form essentially a private security company that would be able to operate within the borders of Myanmar. The goal for China, of course, is to protect its Belt and Road investments as well as all of its economic interests. Because fundamentally we know that the China-Myanmar Economic Corridor, CEMEC, is designed to diminish China's vulnerability due to its overwhelming dependence on the Straits of Malacca. The concern, of course, being if there is China-Taiwan, China-US conflict, Straits of Malacca get closed off, China has huge problems. And China wants to guarantee its fuel supplies to its southern provinces, and so on and so forth. So this is what we have now, is China basically moving ahead with private security contractors. First thing to, I think, note here is this is not the Wagner Group. I mean, this isn't Russia.
Right.
China does not taking, these are not strategically offensive. These are defensive in position. So they're not being utilized the way Russia has it. Also, quite a few people are of the view that China's taken a dim view of how things progressed with the Wagner Group in Russia. I mean, ultimately we saw Prigozhin and the attempted coup against Putin a while back.
Yeah.
So China's not really a big fan of giving up its monopoly on violence through its own military by establishing state-supported, state-controlled private firms and limiting that in any way. But here we are. And Myanmar basically is going to allow this because this is not foreign soldiers, which would be in violation of the Myanmar Constitution, although the government isn't exactly a big fan of the Myanmar Constitution. But this is what's necessary in order to make that occur. Now, the big problem for everyone else is China has two main economic corridors. The China-Myanmar and China-Pakistan. China's seen the same problem in Pakistan. China's had huge security threats in Balochistan and Gwadar, et cetera, to its projects. And the idea of we're never going to militarize this seems to be moving out of date, or at least it's going to raise concerns, because if you place essentially Chinese private military along an entire economic corridor, the perception is you're militarizing that corridor. And this is something that China's always said, no, we're not doing this. This is simply for economic integration and for trade. So neighbors are going to be concerned. This is definitely going to ramp up questions of where Myanmar is going.
It's also what China wanted. If we go back to before COVID, China was hoping to put its security forces into Cambodia. There's wild speculation of its own security forces running rampant in Western countries, the Confucius Institutes, but they wanted to put their boots on ground, their security forces in these Southeast Asian countries, and they said no.
Yeah, I think it's similar, but I think there's some qualitative differences.
Sure.
Because so we see here in Cambodia and other places, it's policing. It's Chinese police, and through formal agreements, cooperation, and so on and so forth. And there's enormous objections to Chinese policing abroad, particularly its impacts on dissidents and others that China does not particularly care for. But this is a step above, because this is security. Policing is different from security, as we all know. So this is going to raise some eyebrows.
And that's happening at the same time as China is backing the Thai crackdown on human traffickers and scam compounds along its border. And our understanding is now that they have established a security unit in Mae Sot on the border, which is what they've wanted in Thailand or around the Myanmar border for quite some time, and now they have it.
China's obviously fed up with the scam compound issue, and it's a full court press in the region to end it. And Thailand finally acquiesced, essentially, to making putting the pressure on Myanmar that it had to do for this nightmarish problem to be resolved.
And Thailand also returned the 40-plus Uyghurs, which really shocked a lot of people.
It was not an ideal...
Including Mario Rubio.
Quite a bit. Yeah, Rubio was obvious, yeah. China's a treaty ally. Thailand is a treaty ally of the United States. So they do expect a little bit more in this area. But this is a good time to pivot to what are the Americans going to do? And I mean, at this point in time, obviously, everyone has that same question about nearly everything, is what is Washington going to do and how is it going to move ahead on the question? And so we have to take a look back at Biden and the Biden administration. And I think we can all be fairly certain that the sanctions that were put on Myanmar haven't succeeded. There's simply too much replacement from other investors, other actors, and so on and so forth, including many from Southeast Asia. So while sanctions exist, they're not going to single-handedly end all of this, as we've seen since they were applied. Could Washington expand them? Yes, there are certain firms in Myanmar that aren't that could be further hit. That could be potentially useful. U.S. passed the Burma Act in 2023, and this all goes to the general thrust of U.S. policy during the Biden administration was we care, this is a problem, we're going to implement sanctions, we're going to provide humanitarian aid, and that aid ramped up and was a vital part for those opposition groups who were opposed to the regime. There was always a further steps that the U.S. could take. The challenge was always that China had very, very clear red lines of what it would respond to, and one of those obviously being the provision of lethal aid and so on and so forth. So the U.S. has been very, very careful not to overstep China's red lines. China is obviously has enormous interest, as we've been discussing, in Myanmar. Where that goes from here is a big question. Whether the U.S. decides that it's going to take a more active role in the region. But at the same time, we have to look at Beijing's reaction to what Washington has done so far. And Beijing's view is, in my view, a misreading. It fundamentally sees everything the U.S. does, supporting opposition and opposition groups in Myanmar, to be the U.S. opposing China's interests. That the U.S. is doing this explicitly based on opposing China's position and making sure that China loses its hegemony in Myanmar. And that's a misreading by Beijing. They haven't really fully grasped it. But the concern obviously is if Washington does, under the new Secretary of State and the new administration, move forward with more high-profile activities or anything that could come close to China's red lines, that they'll simply see this as further evidence for their current worldview of Washington-Beijing conflict over Myanmar.
There was a lot of speculation in regards to what Trump may or may not do. And the kind of got a global focus on everyone, which is a bit disturbing. When it comes down to what's actually happening on the ground, there's the USAID cuts, which has impacted on the the poor, the refugees.
Oh, significantly. We just saw the statement from the UN Special Rapporteur on Myanmar, already saying what a humanitarian disaster that these have facilitated in the country. Whether or not that aid is going to be brought back under a different guise, just earlier today here in Asia, we had the news drop of the Trump administration's new document that essentially is how they're going to move forward with aid policy. The new entity that will be under the State Department to coordinate all of this, et cetera. So with that, there's actually, I think, something of a positive sign that Washington isn't getting rid of everything and that they didn't cut all humanitarian aid programs, but that there is a possibility that Washington will come back onto the plane.
Well, one would hope so. I mean, it was before Christmas, before Trump had taken over as President of the United States, that there were many NGOs and the United Nations who have been forecasting a massive famine that could affect, the numbers touted were like 2.5 million people in the central states around Rakhine, over towards Mandalay, these areas, by around May or June. And now on top of that, you've had the USAID cuts, and the World Food Program is saying 1 million people right now are facing what they call life-saving food shortages. And it's not a good look. I think what I'm getting at is that the information that's coming through from the media is that Trump has got this overall world view and absolutely no idea of the damage that's being caused to individuals on the ground.
It's difficult to evaluate what's in Donald Trump's head and how he's perceiving things, and particularly because the administration's focus so far has been overwhelmingly on the two high-profile conflicts, and Ukraine and the Israel-Palestinian issues. And Myanmar is the third most deadly conflict currently existing on the planet, and of course has received minimal attention in light of what's going on in the rest of the world, and minimal attention by the Trump administration. But how that conflict also plays out, how Ukraine in particular plays out, is quite salient here. Because if we look at Donald Trump making, or if he is able to make, a somewhat quick deal with Russia, whether that's positive or negative for Ukraine, most likely I would say it would be negative if we see that sort of outcome. But the big thing is, what does it do for Russia? It frees up enormous amounts of weapons and military supplies that can be provided to Myanmar. We saw with the visit to Moscow, and I think that's really quite important to note, is the progress that Min Aung Hlaing has actually made in terms of recognition by China and by Russia. So last year we saw that he went to Kunming for the annual conference for the Greater Mekong Subregion, and this was really a precursor to the Russia visit. And this is his fourth visit to Russia, but this is the first time he's ever been formally invited by Putin. And it really was interesting when he was there a couple of weeks ago to look at the just bizarre discussion and dialogue of just intense gratitude. You could see that he was on the ropes, and Russia threw yet another lifeline.
Including a
nuclear reactor, and a very small one, but and of course continuing to support the Myanmar Air Force. Which plays such a decisive role in keeping the regime going, keeping the regime up. But the initial visit to China, stepping stones to a full visit to Russia, and the Russia relationship is consolidating very, very strongly as Russia seeks more influence in the region. Russia also likes to be able to project power in the Indian Ocean. But the knock-on effects as well, we don't want to just include Russia's role, China's role, the United States' role. We also have to look at India. India also, we saw a really significant shift last year in how it was approaching the question. And India has continued engagement with the State Administrative Council and historically had not been engaging with opposition groups, et cetera. That changed last November when, Delhi invited government officials, but then a second round of discussions with opposition figures. And India has really, really, really serious challenges that it has to confront with the Myanmar question that are distinct because of its geographic location.
Right.
As we all know, in eastern India, we see significant conflict, sectarian conflict between Christians and Hindus. And many of these groups in particular have ethnic relations across the border in Myanmar. And of course, the question of gun running between Myanmar and India that exacerbates that violence in India. India then announcing we'll have the entire border fenced in 10 years. But yeah, this is a, India's got a much bigger challenge at this point.
Right, and what they'd really like to do is develop the road networks from India across Myanmar and straight into Southeast Asia's heartland.
This was always, before we had the coup, we were looking at India's previous look east policy, then its act east policy, mm-hmm. and it really seemed we're finally going to move into a period where India is going to develop that east-west economic corridor through Myanmar. That's vital if it's going to more deeply engage with Southeast Asia, mm-hmm. But also for its own security. So some folks have also mooted the idea that India's change in shift in position could be quite helpful, and that Modi's relationship with Trump historically has actually been quite good, mm-hmm. And that this is an area where U.S.-India cooperation actually could be quite positive. So it's a big shift, and I think that's how I really see the Myanmar story right now. We've had a lot of different changes, some relatively small, across the interests of a lot of actors, and it all seems to be coming to a head now, as yep. Particularly as the regime is losing mm-hmm. is not doing well,
not at all.
On the battlefield.
Well, I mean, it's got, I think it depends on who you speak to, but in terms of absolute control, 15%. Control, which is disputed, perhaps 40%. Mm-hmm. The NUG would like to claim a bit more, but either way, it comes across that if it wasn't for the support of the leaderships in Russia and China, Myanmar would struggle to be anything but a failed state.
This is not a government that can survive without external support at this point in time, mm. and external weapons in particular, and hence the Russia relationship so important, China's relationship as well. And China, of course, has the fear massively that the country will fall apart and balkanize, because also China is a border state.
Yep.
As we know, and it's had significant challenges with the Shan groups in the north, and we have seen fighting spill over into Chinese territory, requiring China to basically conduct live fire exercises and make a mm-hmm. very clear, no, please don't do this. This is a mistake. So China needs this to fundamentally, China does not want a balkanized Myanmar, and a balkanized Myanmar also creates much more possibility of greater internal conflict over time. So this is not an outcome that anyone wants,
right.
Overall, but so propping up the current regime and keeping it alive.
Yep.
Stabilization is the name of the game for China. Stabilization is also the name of the game for ASEAN. And stabilization essentially means
we're gonna have those elections.
Yeah, we're gonna have those elections. At least that's what everybody's come up with at the moment.
You spend time up on the border regions of Burma, and it just seems to be no chance in hell, quite literally, that the Karen are not going to declare independence. Mm. That the Arakan army is not going to declare independence. That there's half a dozen other states around that. Whether or not they can and economically survive is another question. And then you've got the National Unity Government,
yep.
Which claims to represent the 20-odd ethnic armed organisations and the People's Defence Forces, mm-hmm. the PDFs. You speak to those people on the ground and they don't view it that way. And they don't see Myanmar as coming out of this as the same geographical boundaries as it once had. So it's very difficult to kind of what is going to come out of this, but I think there's a general feeling that it's approaching.
There does seem to be we've moved beyond the discussion of it's just stalemate,
right?
And I mean, a lot of folks say, oh, it's a stalemate of conflict, and that seems to have changed in the last 6 months or so.
Yep.
Even going back further, I mean going back almost a year, mm-hmm. Where folks are looking at the shift.
No one knows what this is going to look like, but the general feeling is it's approaching, whatever.
I think that's absolutely true, is that there's a sense of imminence almost, mm. that the period of stalemate that many people saw as stalemate is over, and that the conflict is moving ahead, or at least there's a lot of moving parts that are putting a lot of pressure on everything. But ultimately doesn't change the fact of, if you are one of the ethnic armed organizations, how have your interests changed? Have your interests changed? Yes, because they've taken a lot of territory, because they have been quite successful in their outcomes. That, to my mind, doesn't exactly yield an organization that's going to say, all right, time to negotiate, and we're going to give up our what we've gained in terms of territory. We're going to end our, in many cases, multi-decade fight for sovereignty or fight for self-government. It would be rather odd if on the precipice of what many see as victory, that they would...
Yeah, but, just throw it away.
And say, let's go back to a federation and let's go back to this.
How do you rate Malaysian efforts as chair of ASEAN? You know, I ask that because the EAOs and PDFs don't have a lot of time for ASEAN. ASEAN has really dropped the ball. Their five-point peace plan has amounted to not much more than nothing. But at the same time, Malaysia has been cited by the ethnic armed organisations as a potential negotiator. They, along with Indonesia, they have mutual interests in terms of the Rohingya and the Muslim populations. And I think under Anwar Ibrahim, they've made it known that they do want to push ahead with this issue and that ASEAN can't just sit on its thumbs and spout more statements.
No, and Anwar Ibrahim's been very, very clear about seeking to resolve this during Malaysia's chairmanship. He did this in a myriad in speeches leading up to Malaysia's chairmanship and in more recent speeches since Malaysia's become chair. I think the real question, though, is how much influence does Malaysia really have over the EAOs? And it's not a lot. There's a number of ways that Malaysia can go, as chair, can go about this. One colleague has suggested that it reinvigorate ASEAN's commitment to the R2P doctrine, responsibility to protect, and which ASEAN did adopt in 2005, but hasn't really done much with. But it's there as something that ASEAN supports, which could provide more justification for becoming more deeply involved. But I don't think we've seen from ASEAN any enormous progress. They're still figuring it out, and there's differing views among differing members. And that's, of course, the challenge of the consensus-based model of ASEAN, is it's a consensus-based model.
Right. And it just doesn't...
it's not the most flexible.
And
at the same time, you have a huge threat for ASEAN here. Because, okay, what happens to ASEAN centrality if someone else is essentially taking the leadership role? Right now, the leadership role for this looks like it's being held by China. China's the one that is able to exert pressure. We saw that with the pressure on its shift regarding the Three Brotherhoods groups. And we see that with its shift back to supporting the administration in Myanmar. That's not ASEAN leadership in ASEAN questions. That's Chinese leadership in ASEAN questions. Now, ASEAN has mooted and has recognized this to some degree and saying, well, maybe there needs to be another external partner involved. How that develops and evolves, though, is still being worked out.
Would China be a contender for that role, or is it too close already?
I think China's already there. It is able to exert the most pressure.
So who would you tout as a potential external partner?
Well, that's it. Is that nobody else seems really excited to take on this role? As we talked about, the U.S. could, and there are significant security implications for the United States to the Myanmar conflict. I mean, the obvious one being scam compounds and scam centers, and which have flourished in Myanmar, as we've all seen. But the simple geopolitics of it, the location of Myanmar, and becoming more deeply a client state, seeing Chinese naval resources using Myanmar ports, etc. These are all things that should scare Washington very much. But we still don't know where they're going to go with this.
That's what I was going to ask you next, actually. I think the importance of ports is never given the gravitas that it actually deserves. The Americans did make quite a fuss for a while about the re-naval base in Cambodia, and often citing it as China's second international port after Djibouti, and well, Djibouti has a lot of a lot of flags are flown in Djibouti.
I mean, India's expressed concerns about the Chinese signal bases on Myanmar, the Cocos Islands. So other folks do have an interest. India is a potential actor here. Some of the more traditional folks you'd look at for activity in this space, Japan, probably not. Japan.
What about the UK?
Taken a very
Given its colonial history, I don't really want to, but it's, France still steps in with its former colonies on occasion, Cambodia being one example, and the Paris Peace Accords. But
I can't say I've kept up with the nuances of UK Myanmar relations since the coup. But I don't think anybody who's not
choices are limited.
Yeah, the choices are highly limited.
Mm-hmm.
Because remember, if anybody comes in, it has to be with ASEAN, or else you're basically perceived as operating against your commitment to ASEAN centrality. And the one thing everyone says is, we love ASEAN centrality.
And if ASEAN doesn't act, and Myanmar does break up, I think I've been pushing this point home for over the last 18 months, the military cannot win.
Hmm.
If Russian arms come in, yeah, it could make a significant difference, but the wet season's arrived, you've got to fight in the jungles, and the jungles have a nasty habit of levelling the playing field. And it's to the point where, okay, it might extend the military's grip on what power it had, but the idea that of ASEAN centrality, okay, fine, but you might lose Myanmar as a country, and what are you going to do then? Karen state.
ASEAN states have been very clear that Myanmar is a member of ASEAN, it's going to stay a member of ASEAN,
right.
It will always be part of ASEAN. Everyone's been very, very clear about that.
Yep.
In terms of the military question, I still think that it's not a done deal by any means, especially with the new assistance from Russia. I mean, the one area where Myanmar's performed woefully and is not caught up, and it now appears to be catching up, is drone warfare.
Right.
And the new supplies from Russia, et cetera, China's provided in the past. But yeah, this is something that could be quite quite positive. Yeah. Also, when you see the decline in, again, humanitarian aid from the West for that's supported opposition, you do see a shift in resources.
And then, of course, Myanmar supposedly has 5 uranium deposits. There was the head of the Yakuza who is going to be sentenced in a Manhattan court on April 9 for attempting to smuggle out nuclear parts, Kevlar, but also enriched uranium. Mm. It came from somewhere. And interestingly, Japanese don't normally get prosecuted abroad, but he has been nabbed, he has confessed, and he will be sentenced on April 9. And then in the background, you've got the global search for rare earths and minerals, which apparently
Myanmar is about 15%
of
the global supply, which goes to China.
Yep.
And China's not the largest producer, but China's the largest processor of rare earth minerals. Mm-hmm. So this is very much, yes, everyone's firmly aware that Myanmar's one of Myanmar's values for Beijing is precisely that, these rare earth minerals. And that's unlikely to change if the government stays in power.
And of course, the UN envoy for Myanmar, the former Australian Foreign Minister Julie Bishop, she seems to be in a bit of hot water. She's not responding very well after being accused of conflicts of interest, her personal companies being tied in with uranium projects in Greenland and doing
consulting
deals with
work
the
with China.
It's pretty dodgy for a UN envoy.
All the right other qualifications. I mean, former foreign minister, as well as her academic she's chancellor at ANU in Australia. But no, she definitely hasn't handled this well.
And it's a
stunningly bad image.
What bothers me about her appointment is that the position was left unfilled, I think, for about a year.
Mm.
They had a general night session, I think it is, on Myanmar around about April last year, where the UK came out and said that we need this position filled. And Julia Bishop's name was put forward. She got the job. She didn't say a word about Myanmar for about 6 months, but she did go to China. Mm. And in response to these allegations, which came out of the Australian newspapers and was then followed up by the Justice for Myanmar project, the best I can see for a reaction is one email to AP, Associated Press.
Mm.
One would expect more.
It is surprising. It's also surprising in light of, and I think one thing that everyone should, we need to take note of now is how many special envoys for Myanmar there are.
Right.
I mean, because, okay, we have our Australian for the United Nations, we have China's, we have Deng Xijun, and for ASEAN now, of course, we have our old friend Thaksin. who of course doesn't maintain ideal relations or positive relations, it seems, with the EAOs.
But his history in terms of business deals has been rather bright.
But hey, he spent Songkran 12 years ago with Min Aung Hlaing, as a colleague noted.
Right.
So we have, and Malaysia has also gone ahead and appointed its own its own essential envoy for this. The United States, which most people don't know, actually has a position, has a special representative for Myanmar, et cetera. That position has been vacant for quite some time. Whether or not the administration decides if it's going to take a real serious approach to Myanmar, mm-hmm. it's not just going to be on the sidelines. Pointing someone to that position is probably a key indicator if the Trump administration fills that long vacant role.
Right. So ultimately, the politicians that have been surrounding this conflict, either in Myanmar, but whether it's in the United Nations, China, Russia, the United States, Australia, where the UK sits on its former colonies, wherever that, it's all damn confusing, and it always seems to be light years away from what's actually happening on the ground. Mm. There seems to be this kind of when governments adopt that this is our policy. Taiwan is an integral part of China. It is ours, and you can't deviate around it. It's just flat, and it's like Myanmar. It's a country. It will hold elections. Shut up and go away.
Elections are, as we move ahead through this year, and this is going to be I think the election question is just going to be massive. Because the divides are going to be pretty obvious. If ASEAN does move ahead and basically say, okay, we're going to support this, and particularly if it says, oh, and we're going to send observers, and there's no way to hide that that's an enormous break in ASEAN tradition for the last 30 years, and really goes to some of the questions of, okay, how do you send election observers in a context where you don't interfere in each other's affairs? Mm-hmm. If an election observer can't do his job. So if it's an official election observer, how is it able to work? There's workarounds as well. Others have noted you could simply send party representatives rather than a fit, but still, it's a shift if this moves ahead. And it also raises severe questions of if these elections are held with less than 50% of the population even able to vote. Remember, you also have, 2.5 million people displaced outside the country. We'll be in a situation of watching ASEAN members, some of which are solid democracies, essentially supporting what is on its face for everybody, a fraudulent election, and with an outcome that in no way is representative of the Myanmar population as a whole. And that's not a great look, particularly in a region where we've seen very consistent signs of deliberalization, of the rollback of democracy.
How do you see it rolling forward beyond January? More of the same?
The thing about this is there's so many variables on the table. Mm. It's incredibly difficult to make any sort of projection as to where things stand or where things are likely to go a year from now, partially because we simply don't know, one of the big actors, what the United States is going to do, and ASEAN hasn't reached a conclusion. But if I was thinking, if I was pressed, I would say most likely more of the same. I think that we will have obviously lots of activity and lots of discussion and so on and so forth. But if China is able and willing, which it appears now to do, to mm-hmm. fully support the State Administrative Council, Myanmar is able to basically continue to exist and protect what territory it does have with renewed Russian weapons supplies, then it's not looking as though we're going to see a massive color revolution, a massive
right.
shift.
Well, that's been tried.
It has. And at the same time, I think there's also questions of looking at just simply the dynamics of where the opposition, what they're facing, mm. and the reality. How do you move ahead when there's been significant dysfunction within the NLD? Mm-hmm. Folks who are running this are often known as being really from a different era of leadership.
There is that schism in the opposition ranks, where the division between the young fighters mm-hmm. and they want outright victory. They don't want the military to have a special part, quote unquote, in Myanmar society, nor do they think the Burmans, Burmese, I mm-hmm. guess, are entitled to any privileges either. Mm. And it's a propped up failed state.
A propped up failed state. Going back to the beginning, yeah. I think depressingly categorize it that, but as a social scientist, it fits the box. It fits very well with a very strict interpretation of Weber's definition. I mean, how could it not? If you don't control half your territory, how do you maintain a monopoly on violence? You don't.
On that note, Bradley Merg, political scientist, academic, associate fellow with Pacific Forum. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Luke.